Welcome to the Op-Ed Hour for April 9th, 2026. For the Talking Information Center, this is Dan Cobran. Let's start out today talking about former Attorney General Pam Bondi. Bondi tried to kill ethics investigations. Now she'll face one. By Chris Brennan from USA Today. Pam Bondi, who was fired on April 2nd as Attorney General by President Donald Trump, has said that she is moving on to an important private sector role I am thrilled about and where I will continue fighting for the guy who just fired her. Bondi has another fight coming. A broad coalition of lawyers and legal groups is planning to refile an ethics complaint against her with the Florida Bar. The group will once again accuse her of misconduct for using her former position as the nation's top law enforcement official to serve only Trump and not the Americans she swore to serve. The timing of this development is extraordinarily exquisite. Bondi, before she got fired, proposed a new federal regulation that would give the Attorney General the power to hijack the processes that state bar associations use to investigate ethics complaints filed against the Department of Justice lawyers. The 30-day period for public comment about that ended on April 6th. More than a million people left comments on the Federal Register, and it looks like the bulk of them opposed Bondi's proposed regulation. They don't want the DOJ to shield public servants from ethics complaints. Bondi is no longer a DOJ lawyer, so her proposed rule would not protect her. But the lawyers and legal groups looking to hold her accountable have been frustrated so far by the Florida Bar, which rejected the ethics complaint they filed against Bondi in June, stating it does not investigate or prosecute sitting officers appointed under the U.S. Constitution while they are in office. The Florida Supreme Court in October rejected an effort to force the Florida Bar to investigate the complaint. Lauren Ricklin, the executive director of Lawyers Defending American Democracy, told me that an attorney general, like any other lawyer, has an obligation to uphold the Constitution and the Code of Professional Ethics. She is not above the law in any way, Ricklin said in an interview. And the frustration of this has been, of course, that the Florida Bar took the position that indeed the attorney general was above the law and they would not investigate. She said the coalition will be meeting soon to discuss whether to refile the original 23-page complaint or to amend it to include new allegations against Bondi. The coalition includes the group's Democracy Defenders Fund and Lawyers for the Rule of Law. Democracy Defenders Fund, in an email, told me they are fully committed to holding Pam Bondi accountable for her apparent failure to comply with her professional obligations. The original complaint was signed by 68 lawyers, including law professors, retired state and federal judges, and former DOJ attorneys. Two of them, Peggy Quince and Barbara Parente, are former Florida Supreme Court Chief Justices. Both told me they're on board with refiling the ethics complaint against Bondi. The original complaint accused Bondi of serious professional misconduct that threatens the rule of law and the administration of justice while serving as Attorney General. It notes that Bondi, on her first day in that post, issued a memo calling for zealous advocacy in pursuit of Trump's agenda and threatened discipline and terminations for any DOJ staffer who delays or impedes the department's mission. The complaint offers three glaring examples of DOJ lawyers being fired or forced to resign as a result of demands that they act unethically issued by Ms. Bondi or her management team. That included a DOJ lawyer who questioned his department's actions in court during a high-profile deportation case, a lawyer who resigned rather than follow an order to investigate federal spending to prevent pollution despite a lack of evidence, and lawyers who resigned after objecting to the dismissal of a criminal case against former New York Mayor Eric Adams. I'd expect more allegations when the amended ethics complaint gets filed against Bondi. I think it's reasonable to assume we'll be looking at activities since the time of the original filing, Raclean told me. A lot has happened in the last 6 months. All of us who do this work take a lot of care and effort in how we draft these and make sure we have a very solid basis for every allegation. Trump has a long history of lawyers who faced discipline for actions they took on his behalf. Bondi knew that when she took the job as Attorney General, and that job now no longer protects her from the consequences of her actions. Trump fired Bondi because he wants a more unjust Justice Department, by A. Scott Bolden from The Hill. President Trump, who treats the Justice Department as if it were his personal law firm, fired Attorney General Pam Bondi because she failed to weaponize the department sufficiently. He wanted her to vindictively prosecute his enemies as effectively as he demanded, and she failed. She also failed to make the Jeffrey Epstein scandal go away. Trump refuses to accept that the job of the Attorney General is to represent the government and the people of the U.S., upholding the law and the interests of justice on a nonpartisan basis, independent of the president. The president insists that his Attorney General launch politicized prosecutions and lawsuits that serve his interests, creating an unjust Justice Department. Trump fired Attorney General Jeff Sessions in 2018 for not sufficiently corrupting the Justice Department. He has now fired Bondi for the same reason. Bondi did her best to please Trump, carrying out his orders and frequently lavishing praise on him, bordering on buffoonery. Consider the time she absurdly called him the greatest president in American history at a House Judiciary Committee hearing in February. To further curry favor with Trump, Bondi fired many experienced Justice Department lawyers whom she considered insufficiently loyal to the president or who had been involved in investigations of Trump under special counsel Jack Smith. In addition, during Bondi's first 6 months as Attorney General, the Justice Department dropped investigations of more than 23,000 criminal cases to focus instead on Trump's obsession with immigration enforcement. Similarly, FBI Director Kash Patel fired FBI agents who had worked on investigations of Trump and reassigned nearly 3,000 agents to work on immigration enforcement. The firings and reassignments of prosecutors and FBI agents, along with the departure of others who quit, have dangerously weakened America's ability to protect our country against terrorists and other criminals. Unfortunately for Bondi, Trump wanted her to do even more to please him and tasked her with an impossible mission. He expected her to win criminal convictions against current and former government officials who have angered him, even when they apparently committed no crimes. As a former New York State prosecutor, I know from experience that facts and evidence are essential to convict someone of a crime. For this reason, it would be difficult at best for Bondi to have successfully prosecuted former FBI Director James Comey, New York Attorney General Letitia James, six Democratic members of Congress who told members of the military they don't have to carry out illegal orders, and dozens of others Trump targeted for prosecution on trumped-up charges without evidence of wrongdoing. Trump has also ordered the Justice Department to file frivolous lawsuits that have little chance of success, but force the targets to spend big money on legal fees or to settle the cases before trial. Moreover, Trump wanted Bondi to protect him by stopping Congress from investigating and further publicizing the horrific crimes against women and girls committed by Epstein, the late convicted sex offender and former Trump friend. Bondi was unable to stop the release of the Justice Department's Epstein files, which mentioned Trump thousands of times. Trump has denied any wrongdoing in connection with Epstein. In addition, the president keeps wasting taxpayer dollars and manpower by using the Justice Department to try to prove his lie that he won the 2020 presidential election, which numerous recounts proved Joe Biden actually won. Bondi could not show that Trump was reelected in 2020. When he fired Bondi for not being effective enough in carrying out his unrealistic, politicized campaign of retribution against people who investigated him or refused to do as he wanted, Trump replaced her on an acting basis with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who was Trump's personal defense attorney in three criminal cases before he began his second term. It's not known if Trump will nominate Blanche to replace Bondi or if the president will nominate someone else. Whoever gets the job should not be the president's Roy Cohn, the ruthless attorney who had been chief counsel to Senator Joseph McCarthy, Republican of Wisconsin, in the 1950s, and served as Trump's personal lawyer before Trump entered politics. If senators care at all about restoring the Justice Department to become what it was before Trump became president, America's most respected and professional law enforcement agency dedicated to the fair administration of justice, they will refuse to confirm Blanche or another nominee more loyal to Trump than to the U.S. America needs an apolitical Attorney General and Justice Department, where prosecutors and FBI agents don't fear losing their jobs whenever the presidency changes hands between political parties, and where prosecutorial decisions are made based on facts and the law. Republicans should remember that someday, perhaps as soon as 2029, we will have a Democratic president. If they don't want him or her to weaponize and politicize the Justice Department in the future, they should stand firm to stop Trump from doing so now. Dictators weaponize justice. Democracies administer it fairly without regard to politics. Next up, let's talk about the ceasefire in Iran. Trump desperately wants to claim victory over Iran, but the facts say otherwise. By Anthony L. Fisher from MS Now. Whatever inspired President Donald Trump to not unleash an even more severe bombing campaign against Iran on Tuesday night and possibly commit scores of war crimes by obliterating civilian infrastructure in the process, a two-week ceasefire is a positive, if short-term, development. But this should not be celebrated as some kind of victory for America or for the Iranian people, who remain under the yoke of a sadistic theocracy. Over and over in recent days, Trump has pledged to bomb Iranian power plants and infrastructure as part of a mighty American military campaign. In his zeal to project the U.S.'s strength, however, Trump's actions on Tuesday have signaled something else entirely. A weak and unstable leader who has done irreparable damage to America's reputation and the global order. Among the most befuddling developments, why did Trump declare Iran's 10-point proposal, brokered through Pakistani mediators, not good enough on Monday, but suddenly a workable basis on which to negotiate on Tuesday? And how can Trump claim to have fully reopened the Strait of Hormuz when Iran still controls it? This should not be celebrated as some kind of victory for America. Trump's evolution on Tuesday was a global spectacle, starting with a social media post warning that a whole civilization will die tonight, to another post hours before his self-imposed deadline about a double-sided ceasefire if Iran agreed to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt declared on X later on Tuesday, "This is a victory for the United States that President Trump and our incredible military made happen." But it's Iran's rulers and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, among the world's most prolific sponsors of terrorism, who can lay a plausible claim to victory simply by living to stare down the global superpower for another day. by essentially shutting down the Strait of Hormuz at the relatively low cost of blowing up a few oil tankers, Trump's likely illegal war has arguably gifted the Iranian regime unprecedented clout as a regional power. Iranian leaders seem to understand this, with the Wall Street Journal reporting that the regime's Supreme National Security Council's peace plan includes the regulated passage through the Strait of Hormuz under the coordination of the armed forces of Iran, thereby conferring upon Iran a unique economic and geopolitical standing. When MS Now asked the White House on Tuesday for more details on the 10-point plan, an official replied, "We do not negotiate in the press. As President Trump said, the 10-point document is a workable starting point." But some of the plan's details have been reported. According to the New York Times, one of Iran's proposals is lifting the blockade of Hormuz while imposing a fee of roughly $2 million per ship that it would split with Oman, which sits across the strait. Before the war began in late February, roughly 150 ships passed through the strait daily. If this workable basis on which to negotiate, as Trump put it, is implemented, it could amount to a windfall of nearly $55 billion per year for Iran's terror-sponsoring, dissident-murdering dictatorship. For those counting at home, $55 billion is a lot more than the $1.7 billion Iran got from agreeing to a nuclear deal with the Obama administration. Trump has complained for years about that cash transfer, which settled an arbitration dispute between the U.S. and Iran that predated the Islamic Republic's existence. This enraged critics of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, formerly the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was summarily scuttled by the Trump administration in 2018. Trump even mentioned the $1.7 billion figure in his address to the nation last week about his war of choice against Iran. So while there is some good news, Americans can breathe a sigh of relief that unspeakable war crimes aren't being committed against Iranian citizens in our name, we should not lose sight of the big picture. Our commander-in-chief has given us another reason to doubt his leadership, his mental acuity, and his basic decency. Trump's war has killed many civilians, upended the post-World War II international order, and potentially made the Iranian regime a lot richer. I'm not feeling any safer. Are you? Trump gambled on Iran, and he won. By Jake Wallace Simons from The Telegraph. I regret to report that there has been a ceasefire. Given how much everyone seemed to relish their opportunity for outrage after Donald Trump's vow that a whole civilization will die tonight, there will be some disappointment at the news that the president's madman shtick prevailed and there was no mass killing overnight. There are no two ways about it. This was a high-stakes gamble by a barely sane president, and tactically, at least, it paid off. Mohammad Bagher Ghabalif, the Iranian official elevated by assassination to become a de facto interlocutor with the United States, vowed last month that a ceasefire would never be agreed. "We believe we must take the aggressor must strike the aggressor in the mouth so that it learns a lesson," he wrote, claiming that Tehran was determined to avoid the pattern of conflict and temporary ceasefire. "We will break this cycle," he blustered. Funny what a crazy social media post can do. Not for the first time, Trump acted like a mafia boss. "Open the strait or the bridges and power stations get it," and not for the first time, it worked. But did he actually mean it? So thrilling was the collective pearl-clutching that most people ignored the line with which the president signed off his notorious post. What began with a threat to eliminate a civilization ended with the words, "God bless the great people of Iran." That was the key that unlocked the code. What seemed like a genocidal threat against the Iranian people was a tactical rhetoric aimed at the regime. Not that I'm seeking to defend it. Such a radical departure from the norms of leadership set a disturbing precedent and isolated the United States even further from its would-be Western allies. How can any European nation back the White House after that? The fact remains, however, that in this titanic struggle of wills, America has seized the upper hand. The Iranian regime is on its knees, losing so much of its military capabilities and senior leadership that it is desperate for a tactical pause. If it weren't for the lamentable American failure to plan for defending Hormuz, which allowed a bloodied Tehran to place the global economy in a half Nelson, the war may have been over by now. Yes, there has been disappointment in Washington and Jerusalem that the Iranian people have not risen up, but that was always a moonshot. After decades of savage repression and the continual decapitation of promising leaders as they emerged, the movement is fragmented and cowed. As things stand, Trump has won this round. Much, however, rides on what will come next. It is vital to remember that this fanatical regime will never stop wanting us dead. As the late Ali Khamenei made clear in a speech in 2013, its strategy had always rested on the doctrine of heroic flexibility. The wrestler, he said, who shows flexibility for technical reasons should not forget who his opponent is. With this in mind, Iran's 10-point plan must be seen as a starting point, not the end game. To see Tehran offering to abandon the dream of nuclearization and reopen the Strait of Hormuz is welcome. But bitter experience has shown that such pledges cannot be trusted. Moreover, now that negotiations have progressed this far, the regime must be forced to cease exporting terror, both throughout the region and the world via its proxies, stop stockpiling ballistic missiles, and accept some international authority over the strait that means it no longer holds the Joker card. Anything less would condemn us to a return to hostilities in the future. Moreover, if a final deal is agreed, it must be followed by a new era of maximum pressure, including sanctions, diplomacy, and espionage to enable the Iranian people to liberate their country from these fanatics in the longer term. The regime must be perceived as terminally weak, both domestically and across the region. Anything less would presage disaster. For now, however, Trump has used the wiles of a street fighter to pull it out of the bag. Sorry, guys. Victory may not be so impossible after all. During the tense fortnight to come, the White House must ape the enemy by showing flexibility for technical reasons, while never forgetting what is at stake. In the final analysis, what was true 47 years ago remains true today. Iran must be defeated. Now let's turn to NATO. Trump's NATO threat is strategic illiteracy, by Dan Perry from The Hill. Walking away from the World Health Organization after the greatest pandemic in memory and ripping up global trade were foolish. Undermining the Department of Education and the Federal Emergency Management Authority is reckless. Blocking USAID was cruel. But when it comes to crimes against America, President Trump's threats to bolt NATO are the winner. Trump's threats have NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte bolting to Washington in emergency mode. He hopes to calm Trump's rage over Europeans' refusal to join the war against Iran. Rutte, a former Dutch prime minister who once agreed to call Trump daddy, is considered an expert handler of the combustible president. It is madness, all of it. At the very moment the U.S. is projecting power abroad, Trump is openly questioning the alliance that makes such projection possible in the widest sense, far wider than Iran, a colossal strategic illiteracy. NATO is not the charity that Trump claims it is, but an excellent bargain for the U.S. For a tiny fraction of its defense budget, America gets something no rival can replicate: a network of bases, partners, intelligence sharing, and interoperability across Europe, the most economically and militarily capable collection of democracies on Earth. The U.S. gets forward positioning, logistical depth, and allies who multiply its power. That is why NATO has endured for more than seven decades. It is one of the most successful strategic investments in modern history, a system designed to prevent great power war, deter adversaries, and extend U.S. influence without direct conquest. This is the infrastructure of global leadership, the echo of a time when we wanted it and also thought it would do good for humanity, not just for America's ability to grab assets. The oft-repeated claim that the U.S. pays for NATO is simply false. Washington contributes roughly 16% of NATO's common budget, amounting to less than 0.1% of America's defense spending. What it does spend on its military more broadly reflects its status as a global superpower, and indeed a country that even before World War II sought to dominate the Americas. When Trump talks about NATO's cost, he relies on a simple sleight of hand. He points to the roughly $1.2 trillion that NATO countries spend on their militaries as if that money is being paid into NATO itself, as if the U.S., which indeed accounts for about two-thirds of the figure, is footing some vast alliance bill. It isn't. NATO's actual shared budget, the only money countries collectively contribute to the alliance, is about $4 billion a year. The vastly larger figure is what each country spends on its own military, under its own command, for its own purposes. The U.S. would spend the overwhelming majority of its $800 billion defense budget whether or not NATO existed, simply because it is a global superpower. NATO just helps organize and augment that. Meanwhile, U.S. defense firms depend heavily on European procurement and joint production related to NATO modernization, anchoring the U.S. defense industry. European arms imports surged in 2020 to 2024, such as the more than half of Europe's arms imports in that period came from the U.S., and U.S. global export share rose to 43%. In the broader sense, transatlantic trade reached $2 trillion in 2024, making it the largest and most integrated economic relationship in the world, supporting American jobs and markets. Europe, whose nations comprise the bulk of NATO, is in general the largest source of inward flows into the American economy, with transatlantic investment exceeding $5 trillion and supporting more than 16 million jobs on both sides of the Atlantic. The current confrontation with Iran does not expose NATO's weakness, as Trump suggests, but rather his basic misunderstanding of what NATO is. The alliance is not a coalition for wars of choice, but a defensive pact whose members are bound to defend each other. In this conflict, the U.S. was not attacked, but rather initiated military action in Iran, and he did so without so much as consulting European allies. There is therefore no obligation for the allies to join in such a campaign. Trump now tweets that the alliance is a paper tiger, and he has told an interviewer that Putin knows it. But if Putin thinks that of NATO, it is probably because Trump calls it obsolete, and for a few confounding Greenland-focused weeks in January, refused to even rule out force against NATO member Denmark. Europeans are enraged and wondering if the U.S. can ever be trusted again. In Trump's worldview, alliances are not enduring commitments, but temporary arrangements subordinate to raw power. Everything is always negotiable and little attaches to values. But that is not how NATO works, and it is the opposite of why it exists. The alliance was built to replace the law of the jungle with a system of mutual defense among democracies. For more than 70 years, it has succeeded, helping prevent major wars in Europe, deterring authoritarian expansion, and anchoring a broader system of stability and prosperity. Fortunately, there is a practical reality that Trump appears to ignore. He cannot simply quit NATO on a whim. The treaty requires 1 year's notice to withdraw, and the U.S. Congress has also restricted President's ability to exit without legislative approval. Any unilateral attempt to leave would likely trigger a constitutional clash. Beyond that, NATO's system of bases, command structures, and integrated planning would take years to unwind. A wise successor, almost any imaginable successor, would cancel a plan so idiotic. Whatever Trump does, the rest of the alliance will therefore probably keep its powder dry, waiting for the nightmare to end. And for now, though, Trump is weakening NATO by behaving as he does, making America weaker and war more likely. As for Putin, not since Stalin was basically handed Eastern Europe in the wake of World War II, has a leader in Moscow been handed a greater gift. China's Xi Jinping is certainly laughing with pleasure as well. This sordid, ridiculous crisis is like a conspiracy by the White House against the U.S. NATO, Iran, and the Interests of Nations by Stephen Soukup from American Greatness. The longer the war with Iran drags on, the clearer it becomes that America's allies have little interest in doing things that allies traditionally do. Some European leaders have merely said they will not participate in the war, that they have no interest in fighting Donald Trump's battles. Others have taken concrete steps to hinder American efforts, notably by denying American troops access to bases in their countries or denying them permission to fly over their airspace. Others still, namely France's Emmanuel Macron and Spain's Pedro Sanchez, appear to have determined that their region's welfare no longer aligns with that of the United States, which is a legitimate position, but hardly one that would define an ally. The clearer it becomes that America's long-standing erstwhile allies are unhappy with current arrangements, the more agitated President Trump's domestic opponents, on the left and the right, grow. They are certain that Trump's Middle East conflict is the straw that will break the back of the camel that is the post-World War II global order. He is an abomination, they insist, a simplistic fool who knows nothing about the history and grandeur of NATO, the importance of the transatlantic partnership, or the bonds that tie the West together and make its preservation the central purpose of American foreign policy. He will destroy everything and leave the world and the nation worse off because of it. The more agitated President Trump's domestic opponents grow, the more obvious it is that most of those who purport to be experts on foreign affairs have forgotten the first rule of realistic foreign policy. Nations have no eternal allies and no perpetual enemies, only eternal and perpetual interests. This near-exact paraphrasing of the proposition dates to an 1848 speech by Lord Palmerston in the House of Commons. It is, however, a notion that dates to antiquity, having been elucidated as far back as the 5th century BC in Thucydides' Millennium Dialogue. More recently, Charles de Gaulle used it as the justification to withdraw France from NATO's integrated command structure in 1966. Yet somehow, amazingly, NATO and the West managed to survive. There are several profound ironies in the fact that the nation's best and brightest are unhappy with President Trump for starting a war that they believe will destroy NATO and end the global order. The first of these can be seen in Europe's reaction to the current war. The French and Spanish leaders, in particular, seem to have decided that their nation's interests are not the same as the United States. What this suggests is that the urge to blow up NATO is hardly Trump's alone. If Europe is willing to pursue its own interests, even when they conflict with America's, then the transatlantic friendship has already been damaged and has clearly evolved into something other than an alliance. The second of these stems from Trump's critics' belief that NATO is a values-based organization in the first place, that it binds the world's greatest democracies together in an effort to ensure the maintenance of an order based on their common ideals. In truth, NATO has always been a realist organization, based almost entirely on the understanding that nations have interests they must protect, irrespective of naive dreams of shared values and common hopes. NATO, it should be recalled, was not created immediately in the aftermath of World War II, but rather 4 years and countless world-changing events later. When the war ended, the American side, led by the largely delusional Franklin Roosevelt, approached the pending peace with fantasies about global governance and camaraderie with Stalin and the Soviets. As I've noted before in these pages, the political scientist and historian of the Cold War, Amos Perlmutter, wrote that Roosevelt's vision for a post-war world was neo-Wilsonian, totally at odds with reality. He would help create a new international order, presided over in an equal partnership by the two emerging superpowers, the United States and the USSR, and buttressed by the newly created world organization, the United Nations. More damningly, perhaps, George Kennan, a high-ranking diplomat in the Roosevelt administration who served in the American embassy in the Soviet Union, put it this way in his memoirs. The truth is, there's no avoiding it, that Franklin Roosevelt, for all his charm and skill as a political leader, was, when it came to foreign policy, a very superficial man, ignorant, dilettantish, with a severely limited intellectual horizon. Roosevelt knew nothing about Russia and very little about Europe. This in itself would not have been so bad. What was worse was that he did not seek or value the advice of those who did know something about these places and could have told him something about them. And speaking of Kennan, he is best remembered by history as the man who created the language and the policy paradigm that would set the foundation for the hard-headed, realist Truman Doctrine. And that doctrine, in turn, would recognize the importance of a strong and reliable transatlantic partnership, leading to the establishment of NATO in 1949. On February 22, 1946, Kennan, then the chargé d'affaires at the American Embassy in Moscow, sent what would come to be called the Long Telegram, an 8,000-word missive in which he laid out the process of decision-taking in the Soviet Union and warned that it was wrong and useless to attempt to appeal to subjective feelings on the part of Soviet statesmen or negotiators. The bottom line, Kennan argued, was that there can be no permanent peaceful coexistence with Soviet Russia, that the United States would be unwise even to attempt to achieve such an end, and that it would be far better served to contain Soviet aggression at a series of checkpoints. Kennan's telegram alarmed the rest of the Truman administration, many of whom were as naive about the Soviets as the late FDR. Kennan was recalled from Moscow and shortly thereafter was put in charge of creating the State Department's Policy Planning Office, which was intended to establish a program for dealing with the mounting economic and social problems in Europe. Kennan's telegram and his advocacy of containment morphed into Dean Acheson's domino theory, which became the Truman Doctrine, described by Kennan in his famous X article in the July 1947 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. Officially titled The Sources of Soviet Conduct, the essay argued that the antagonism demonstrated by Soviet leadership towards the Western democracies at the time could not be mitigated by diplomacy because it was inherent in the internal system of power in the USSR. It argued that the United States government should establish a program to provide economic and technical aid to the non-communist nations of Europe, not because of shared values, but for purely transactional reasons. The United States would provide the money, the arms, and the manpower to deter the Soviets, while Europe would serve as front lines in the battle against the communist menace. While most Americans of a certain age think of containment and the domino theory as aspects of American foreign policy in Asia, Korea, and Vietnam, in truth, they were developed to apply in Europe to save the western half of the continent from the fate of their neighbors to the east. The third profound irony in the experts' constant laments that Trump's unilateral war of choice might destroy NATO is that the modern presidential propensity to wage war without congressional approval is derived almost solely from the negotiations around the establishment of NATO. The Europeans were concerned that the clause in the U.S. Constitution that vested Congress with the right to declare war would cause a delay in American help if Russia invaded Western Europe. In response, the Truman team advanced the Covert Operations Initiative, codified in National Security Council Directive 10/2. The directive formally authorized the Central Intelligence Agency, established less than a year earlier, to coordinate intelligence gathering across agencies and to conduct covert activities against hostile foreign states or groups or in support of friendly foreign states or groups. Although seemingly benign and even necessary, 10-2 provided the justification for many of the CIA's early adventures, as well as Truman's deployment of American troops to Korea on June 30, 1950. The late great historian journalist David Halberstam described the police action in Korea as the last thing anyone, civilian or military, wanted to do. Nevertheless, Truman determined that it was in the nation's interests and that going to Congress for approval was unnecessary and would just slow down the process. National Security Directive 10-2 was formulated and written in response to Europe's concerns regarding NATO, but it was first used by Truman to fight communists in Asia. The rest, as they say, is history. In other words, the idealist transatlanticists who spend their days carping at Trump might be better served by assessing and addressing their misunderstanding of history, especially the history of NATO. It was and always has been an organization based almost entirely on foreign policy realism and the perceived shared interests of the American and European peoples. If those interests have changed, as Europe's kvetching suggests, then so be it. NATO can still be an important tool for American foreign policy, but to do so, it must adapt to the post-Cold War realities, and the Americans and their erstwhile allies must find new interests that hold them together. Now let's look at politics and Twitch streamer Hassan Piker. Hassan Piker is a bright, clear red line for Democrats, by Kathy Young, from Newsday. How far can Democrats go in allying themselves with the far left? Is the big tent big enough for Hassan Piker, a live streamer many regard as anti-Jewish and anti-American? This question flared up in the past week before Piker's scheduled appearances Tuesday with Michigan Senate candidate Abdul El Sayed on the campaign trail. Moderates have urged Democrats to shun Piker, citing his offensive views and statements and comparing him to anti-Semitic far-right influencer Nick Fuentes. Meanwhile, progressives such as California House member and presidential aspirant Ro Khanna have said that Democrats cannot miss the opportunity to reach potential voters if they want to take Congress and eventually retake the White House. This question matters for those who are not Democrats but strongly believe that the reins of power must be wrested away from the Republican Party in its present form, and that President Donald Trump must be curbed. Generally, big tents are good and purity tests are bad, but sometimes a line must be drawn, and in Piker's case, it's a bright and clear red line. It's just as clear for the Republicans and Fuentes. Piker's defenders say the accusations of anti-Semitism are a smear and that he does not belong in the same category as Fuentes, who has openly mocked the Holocaust and denounced the evils of international Jewry. By contrast, Piker has ostensibly disavowed anti-Semitism and stressed that his opposition is to Israel, not Jews. Yet, Piker's rhetoric denouncing Israel as a fascist settler colonial apartheid state effectively demonizes the vast majority of Jews. He has not only equated even liberal Zionists with neo-Nazis, he has said that in a just world, anyone who has shown any sort of positive feelings about the state of Israel would be excluded from public life. That covers the vast majority of American Jews, including those who are highly critical of Israel's present government and of its war in Gaza. Piker has described the terror group Hamas as the lesser of two evils and expressed sympathy for the October 7th raids on Israel, dismissing the report of rapes committed by Hamas militants on that day as unimportant. Israel isn't the only subject on which Piker has made his vile comments. He has said that America deserved the September 11th attacks and gloated at the idea of a repeat of that awful day because of America's involvement in the Middle East. He's expressed enthusiasm for communism, saying that the United States unfortunately won the Cold War. He has crudely mocked Vietnamese refugees who spoke of people suffering under communism. It's hard to say how much voting power Piker can bring in for the Democrats. While he has millions of followers on social media sites, the audience for his streams on political topics is far smaller. Given his extreme and nasty rhetoric, he might well alienate more voters than he brings in. And he's more a bully than an ally, refusing to endorse Democratic candidates, including then-Vice President Kamala Harris in 2024, whom he considers too pro-Israel. But even if embracing Piker can boost the Democrats, it would also move them in the direction of today's Republican Party, not in terms of actual policies or bills, but of flirting with radicalism and hate and refusing to repudiate odious allies. The opposition's goal for America cannot just be just to defeat Trump and his toxic populism. It is to bring decency, sanity, and civic solidarity back into American political life. Why Do Elite Democrats Fear Hassan Piker? By Bhaskar Sankara from The Guardian. Gas has topped $4 a gallon for the first time since 2022. The president's approval rating just fell below 40%. The war in Iran is entering its sixth week, with thousands dead and no end in sight. The Strait of Hormuz is blockaded, food prices are climbing, and U.S. households are staring down hundreds of dollars in added living expenses. So naturally, the Democratic Party has found something truly urgent to focus on, a Twitch streamer. The latest intra-party panic was triggered by Abdul El-Sayed, a progressive running in Michigan's competitive Democratic Senate primary, who announced that Hassan Piker would appear at two campaign rallies alongside him. The response from the party establishment was swift. Representative Brad Schneider branded Piker an unapologetic anti-Semite. Michigan's own Senator Alyssa Slotkin, a former Pentagon official, weighed in with her condemnation, as did Representative Haley Stevens, one of El-Sayed's primary rivals. Another opponent, Mallory McMorrow, went so far as to liken Piker to Nick Fuentes, a white supremacist who has enthusiastically praised Adolf Hitler on camera. When Politico came calling, both Cory Booker and Ruben Gallego rushed to declare that they would refuse an invitation to appear on Piker's stream. It was quite the pile-on, but who is Hassan Piker, and why have some Democratic Party elites branded him enemy number one? Piker is one of the most watched political streamers in the country. His audience skews young and male, exactly the demographic that deserted Democrats in historic numbers in 2024. He's a socialist who talks about class politics, foreign policy, and the failures of the American system with a directness that clearly resonates with millions. Last month, he joined a solidarity convoy bringing humanitarian aid to Cuba. He's also the guy who turned down $500,000 to play poker on stream and who walked away from a $1 million offer from Polymarket for his 2024 election night coverage. At a time when surveys show nearly 40% of young men admit to betting more than they can afford, that consistency is worth something. It also puts Piker on a higher plane than some establishment figures. Stephanie Cutter, Obama's former deputy campaign manager, announced just days ago that she's excited to be advising Kalshi, one of Polymarket's prediction market competitors. The establishment's moral compass is conveniently selective. Has Piker said things that are offensive? Of course. He's a streamer who broadcasts for hours every day. The medium almost guarantees it. But the specific charges being recycled against him are years old. A 2019 remark that America deserved 9/11, which he has since walked back as a hyperbolic critique of U.S. foreign policy, forceful criticism of Israel and its crimes in Gaza, and the time he called ultra-Orthodox Jews inbred. Inbred is an unfortunate but standard piece of American insult vernacular. Piker himself uses it freely against white nationalists, neo-Nazis, and anyone else he dislikes. He has said he regrets applying it to Jewish people specifically and will not do so again. None of this is new. And none of it makes McMorrow's comparison of Piker to Nick Fuentes, an actual Holocaust denier, anything but ludicrous. None of it was a problem for establishment Democrats until the day El Sayed announced his rally. The framing of Piker as a threat to all that is decent is nothing but a campaign tactic designed to kneecap a progressive challenger in a primary race. It's worth reflecting on the power of the respective sides in this controversy. Cory Booker, for example, is a United States senator. Hassan Piker is a guy with a laptop and an audience. Booker supports a bill that would unconstitutionally ban boycotts of Israel and has repeatedly voted to arm a country that has killed tens of thousands and leveled the Gaza Strip. But a streamer who says strident things about it from his living room is somehow beyond the pale? The double standard tells you everything about what the establishment considers dangerous. Not the exercise of actual state power, but the existence of a popular voice they can't control. On Pod Save America, Booker said he'd never even heard of Piker before this past week. This is revealing in a way Booker probably didn't intend. A senator who aspires to lead the party can't be bothered to know who commands the attention of millions of the young voters he claims to want back, but he can be mobilized overnight to condemn the guy? His priority clearly isn't engaging with the audience, though he does find time to text message back and forth like teenagers with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's president. After 2024, Democrats conducted an anguished postmortem about why young men were abandoning the party. Pundits filled columns wondering where the party's Joe Rogan was, someone with cultural reach who could talk to disaffected men on their own terms. As Ryan Zitgraff pointed out, they got one, and the party's first instinct was to try to cancel him. What this episode makes painfully clear is that for too many leading Democrats, the priority is defeating progressives within their own ranks and triangulating their way back to power behind a well-heeled professional base. Palestine has become a populist issue among young Americans in a way that the Democratic mainstream still refuses to comprehend, not just in Brooklyn and Ann Arbor, but in rural and working-class communities where people are angry and where anger at the human cost of U.S. foreign policy doesn't break neatly along the lines the party expects. We are living through an era of extremes, a war in Iran that almost no one asked for, an economy that's squeezing ordinary people, and a president whose approval is cratering. The old playbook of moderation and scolding isn't just uninspiring, it's a proven loser. Abdul El-Sayed understands that you can't meet this moment by hiding from the people who are actually reaching the voters you've lost. The Democratic establishment's problem isn't Hassan Piker. It's that they've run out of ideas and they'd rather police who progressives talk to than offer the country something worth voting for. Well, that's all the time I have for today. You've been listening to the Op-Ed Hour for the Talking Information Center. This has been Dan Cobran. Have a great rest of your day.